Okay, like I said, my name is Max Andrews. Just a little bit about me. I'm a second-year grad student in the MA in philosophy program. Are there any philosophy majors in here by chance? Yeah, usually not. How many of you are freshmen? Wow. Okay, that's a lot. Second semester, most likely? Okay. I'm currently doing my research in the fine-tuning argument for the existence of God based on cosmology and physics in light of the idea of a multiverse, many universes. So you can roll your eyes when I'm not looking, but that's fine. Yeah, that's pretty much about me. Okay. I got the email last night at like 9:30 about this lecture, so just just bear with me. It's the grad student classic email. Hey, can you teach class tomorrow morning? Yeah. Anyways, did y'all start the slide at all last class? Okay. Well, I find this discussion, or I'm just gonna put these things all up here. I find the discussion of any existential ideas or absurdity to be honest philosophy. You know, when a lot of times with existentialists like Nietzsche or Camus or Sartre, a lot of times, and I'm sure you might have heard it in GED class, where you just play the Christian trump card of, well, it's a self-defeating idea of the idea that there is no moral values or that there is no truth. And so you say, all right, well, it's self-defeating, you trump it, and you're not going to listen. But the thing with existentialism is that once you start listening and you get past that, when you hear where they're coming from and where they're going with it, it's very interesting and it's honest and depressing. First off, there are two kinds, or existence precedes essence. What that means is that it's kind of the slogan or the motto for existentialism. And what it's trying to say is that man finds himself just put into this world. And only afterwards can he define who he is. Only after he goes through experiences can he actually say what his essence may be, or a self-constructed essence. That'll unravel here in a little bit. All right. Existence is absurd. There's two types of absurdity. There's objective and subjective. All right. I'm sure we've heard these terms before, right? All right, objective meaning, or it's the closest idea to absolute. It's not absolute, but it's the closest idea or translation. Subjective is, of course, relative to the subject. All right, subjective, let's start with the subjective absurdity. Subjective absurdity is something that you've all probably experienced in your life. It's when you're going through usually some type of problem or ordeal in life, and you're just in a moment of despair. And in that moment, you just recognize how pointless your situation is, how pointless your life may be. You feel meaningless. You feel valueless. It's the epitome of genuine depression in the sense of it's an existential despair, which is like a whole nother level of depression. But it's interesting how they turn the tides on this. And so you'll find subjective absurdity throughout the Bible. When you look at, say, Psalm 10, when the psalmist says that, and he asks God, why have you hidden your face from me? And he says, why is your presence not here? I'm not knowing that you are close to me. I feel like you've abandoned me. I find that throughout the Psalms. Or Psalm 42, as the deer pants by the stream, so my soul pants for you. This is something that you'll find, especially in Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is probably my favorite book of the Bible because it's honest. It's kind of weird when you first approach it because it's saying that, you know, everything is vanity, vanity of vanities, all that so forth. And what Solomon is doing in that book is he's saying, you know, I've tried to construct my own value, my own meaning, but it's falling short. I'm recognizing that no matter how much I get into botany, I can't be happy, or how much I get into women or wines or games or whatnot. So that's subjective absurdity. Were there any questions about subjective absurdity? Kind of makes sense. All right, objective absurdity is the idea that there really isn't any actual meaning, value, or purpose in life, or anything in the universe. So subjective absurdity, with subjective absurdity, there you can still have meaning. You're just not aware of it, or you're not feeling it, or you're denying it. And so that meaning, purpose, and value may actually be there. You're just not recognizing it under subjective absurdity. Under objective absurdity, no matter how long or how hard you try to find meaning or construct purpose, it's not going to be there. So you'll typically find these questions, particularly objective absurdity, this is the lecture on humanism, but in a non-theistic context. And so the question is, why must teleology depend on God? Teleology meaning purpose, meaning, and so forth. Axiology, have you been through these in the class? Yeah, axiology is moral values, aesthetics, and this primarily concerns teleology as well as values, axiology. So the question is, why must it depend on God? So consider this, and I'll explain it to you. All right, I'll translate that. Have you gotten into logic yet? A little bit, maybe? No? Okay. What this horseshoe symbolizes is it's an implication or an if-then statement. And this is just predicate terms in the sense of, translation. If God does not exist, then objective teleology does not obtain. Or that it does obtain, actually. So this is called a tilde. This little squiggly line means not. And so you kind of have to read them backwards. And so what it's saying is if God doesn't exist, there's still moral values. And this is how they're going to try to get around the idea of absurdity, that there is still a meaning even though God doesn't exist. And they'll recognize that, you know, there is a sense of objective meaning. There has to be some type of teleology. But when you look at that proposition where teleology obtains, then if that is necessarily true, then it follows that the first conditional, the non-existence of God, has to be true as well. So if the consequent is necessarily true, that yes, we're recognizing that there is meaning and purpose, then this has to be true as well. So what are you to say if the non-existence of God brings about teleology? What are your thoughts on that? Is it possible to have God without teleology? Meaning or purpose?
God still exists? Isn't it possible that God could have created a world with no meaning?
if it was in his nature, I think that we could say that God could have created a universe with no teleology. But which is very interesting, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But my question was, if God doesn't exist, can there still be meaning, purpose, and value? No? Well, in this idea, we're just treating God as a necessary truth. I mean, I think we can kind of say that God's existence is a necessary truth. But if the antecedent and the consequent, the antecedent is the first term, the consequent is the second. If they're both necessary truths, and we recognize that the consequent is necessarily true, then suppose it's necessarily true that God doesn't exist. All right. What you'd have to do to get to the idea that God does exist and teleology obtains is that if you were to say, this is still teleology obtains, but the first term is an Anselmian notion of God. And I think you're going to get to this when you start talking about the ontological argument and other arguments for the existence of God. Anselm was an early medieval Christian, and this is where we get the idea of a maximally perfect being. And Anselm said, if we can conceive of a maximally perfect being, then that being must exist and is greater than that. There's a lot more to it, but or in the essence, the present argument is if it's possible for a maximally perfect being to exist, then that being exists in some possible world. If it exists in some possible world, then it exists in all possible worlds, and if it exists in all possible worlds, it exists in the actual world. It's kind of sneaky how that works. But, and so, all right, instead of just treating this as God as a necessary truth, when we add the notion of an Anselmian understanding of God, it encompasses teleology. So in the sense of, to affirm this doesn't make any sense. It's nonsensical. It's impossible, because the Anselmian notion already encompasses teleology. And this is how we would generally understand God, just making a distinction between a mere necessary truth and the Anselmian understanding of God, that he encompasses all metaphysical truths in the sense of, if meaning is true, then it comes from God. Do you see a distinction there? Any questions about that, or was this just word tricks? Okay. So, when we got the tilde there, it doesn't make any sense. And so, you'd have to view it like this. This is what the Christian would say. If the Anselmian God exists, that implies that teleology obtains. So that's the only real way of looking at it, contrary to objective absurdity. Okay. All right. Well, here's another one for you. All right. Never mind the EA, the Anselmian notion. I'm just going to put God. So, and I'll explain this again. All right. That's a sideways alpha, but I know that looks a little confusing, so let me explain it. All right, this might be a little confusing. Let me. There you go. lowercase alpha. All right, what that means is this is a famous theorem by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Has anybody heard of Dostoevsky? A couple of you? This is from his book. I mean, it's not exactly spelled out like this, but it's from his book, The Brothers Karamazov. You'll usually find this referred to in the discussions on the problem of evil. It's a very sobering book. Anyways, what this says, and when you... It's really confusing, because when you start reading, you start going like this. Like, you start going forward and backwards, and then you finally get to the end. What this says is, necessarily, if God does not exist, then for any action, alpha, that action is not wrong. So it basically says, all things are permitted. If God does not exist, then nothing can be wrong. All things are permitted. So, if you look at this teleologically or in an axiological way of values, if God does not exist, then it's okay for that Norway killer to do what he did. It may just be unfashionable for him to do that. But it's not wrong that he did that. And so this is just a follow-up from that second proposition down there. Necessarily, if God does not exist, then for any and all actions, that action is not wrong. Yeah. No, the little square means necessarily. So this is what I do when I take notes. I used to, I was a biblical studies undergraduate, and I always took notes on my computer. Then I realized I didn't really learn that well. And so I was always right. And so in order to keep up, you got to write shorthand. And so, like, if you want to say necessarily, I'll always put the little square. If I say God, I always just use a theta, or possibility is a diamond. But yeah, you're not expected to know. You don't need to memorize these, but it helps you understand the idea of absurdity. So the little square is necessarily. The little tilde is not. I think you'll get into a little bit of the symbolic stuff. The upside down A means for any and all. And so wrong W means wrong here. So, yeah, I'm not putting these up there saying, like, go for it, you should know this. That's why I'm trying to explain it as best I can. Okay, were there any other questions about that? Or any objections? You have no idea what's going on? Okay, where did I lose you? With the symbols? Okay. All right. Well, maybe if you see like it translated into a sentence, maybe you can start matching words up with the symbol. Okay. All right. It's awkwardly low. Which one do you want me to translate? You want me to start with the smaller ones? Okay. Awkwardly low. Oh, dang it. Right, this is the translation for the top one. Oh, wait, no, it's not. Okay, that's the translation for the bottom one. If the Anselmian understanding of God exists, or the Anselmian God exists, then teleology obtains. Remember, teleology is meaning, purpose. The Anselmian notion of God is the idea that God is a maximally perfect or great being. So, one of the famous objections is, I can think of a lot of maximally perfect things. I can think of the maximally perfect island. Is that island God? Well, what would you think about that? What would you say? If God is the greatest conceivable or the maximally perfect being, then if I can conceive of a maximally perfect island, is that not God under that definition? Are there any problems with it? Yeah.
Are you saying that really a maximally perfect being, do we have to imagine? Do we have to be able to conceive it? Or can it be something we cannot?
In the sense of, if you can conceive of it, it's greater. All right, well, if you think of a greatest conceivable island, the problem with that is, and I may be jumping ahead in the class, what that would say is that, how many palm trees would that look like? Or how many ukuleles could you play? Or, how many coconuts are in each tree? And so, why not 29 palm trees plus one? Or how many, whatever, seashells plus one? You can always think of something greater. And so it encompasses all perfections. You start with an island. Feel free to start with an island or cocaine or something, and then start making that thing greater. Well, how much bigger is it? Is physical substance greater than immaterial, and you start getting existence greater than non-existence. So that's where that idea comes from. And when you think of God, you've probably got this idea of God in your head. This idea of God, treating God as just a necessary truth, doesn't encompass all of what we understand God to be. And this is how you'll see this argued quite often, that treating God as just a necessary truth, logically equivalent to shooting kids is wrong. They're logically equivalent in the sense of it's necessarily true that you should not shoot kids. Did that help at all, or did I lose you a little bit? A little bit more? Do you want a little bit more? Okay. Okay, do you get the distinction between God as the necessary truth and God as a maximally perfect being? You do get that distinction? If you get that distinction, you're tracking along with me in the sense of, if teleology obtains, these are logically equivalent, really. But the Anselmian understanding of God is much more than just a necessary truth. It's metaphysically necessarily true instead of just logically. He is morally perfect. He is all-knowing, all-smart, whereas just treating God as a necessary truth doesn't really encompass all of that. Okay. The idea of absurdity hasn't always been in the idea of philosophers. It permeates throughout the sciences as well. A little bit in Darwin, as we'll see in a little bit. But he's a physicist, I want to say from Hawaii. His name is Victor Stenger. Has anybody ever heard of Victor Stenger? He wrote this book called God the Failed Hypothesis. It's a New York bestseller. And in it, he describes himself in an airplane flying over Wyoming or something. I don't remember where he was flying over. But he looked down and he started recognizing how pointless everything was, in the sense of the more that we understand science, the more we understand the world, the more we understand the universe, the more we realize how pointless it is. And his approach to this, it's kind of the converse of the fine-tuning argument. You know, the fine-tuning argument for the existence of God says, you know, look at the law, the fundamental constants, the speed of light, the electromagnetic force, the strong nuclear force, the force of gravity, and, you know, they're so finely tuned that if they are different, the universe wouldn't be able to exist. And so there has to be a mind to do that. But what Stenger does with this is he has a very interesting look on it. He says, you know, if Earth is the only habitable place in the universe, then it doesn't really appear like the universe was fine-tuned for life. Because 99.99 repeating percent of the universe is hostile to life. And so we just happen to be in a convenient spot for us to live. And so the universe is just absurd. We're just here accidentally. And if it was design, it was stupid design. Very interesting when you think about that. If the universe 99% of the time does not allow for life, then why make an argument for the existence of God based off of that millionth of a percent chance? Okay. All right. I know we'll get to Camus in a second, but Nietzsche. We've all heard of Friedrich Nietzsche, right? All right. What do you know about Nietzsche? God is dead. Somebody said something else? No. God is dead. Anything else about Nietzsche that you're aware of? He died in a mental hospital? He did.
He gazed into the abyss.
Ah, there we go. That's nice. I wasn't expecting that. That was good. We're actually going to talk about that in a little bit. Very interesting. Pardon?
He was a nihilist.
Yeah, that's what I was looking for. And this, but did they teach that in Genie D by chance? Okay, let me try to set the record straight. I know I'm only a grad student, but I'm going to make an argument to suggest that what you were taught is actually wrong, in the sense of Nietzsche wasn't really a nihilist. Because, and so I know I'm just going against the grain of liberty here, but Nietzsche was actually terrified of nihilism, of the idea of there being no meaning or purpose. And so that's where we get the notion of the Übermensch. Has anybody ever heard of the Übermensch? Yeah, a few of you. The translation into English would be the Superman, the Overman. And so it's a German word. And what he does is that he calls on the Übermensch to provide meaning here. When he looks at Christianity, that was his despair. That's what he looked at as nihilistic, in the sense of Christianity is a pointless, meaningless, and valueless worldview. And so this is where we get the idea of his nickname, the philosopher with a hammer, or philosophizing with a hammer, in the sense of he wanted to just crush all idols. And any type of religion or anything associated with religion was nihilistic. And so his call for the Superman to come, for the Übermensch, which is a higher state of being, it's the person who has obtained the most, who actually understands meaning, value, and purpose, and can provide that for other people. And so, it's really interesting how Nietzsche sets this up, and you're going to see a very nice parallel between Darwin and Nietzsche. It's very interesting. In Darwin's Descent of Man, he argued that human nature is not the result of God, but the fact of it having arisen by evolution, instead of having been placed there by a God for hope and higher, greater destiny, greater future. And so our ideas of who we are and where we're going are only an accidental byproduct of Darwinian evolution. And so Nietzsche kind of runs with this. And in Nietzsche's The Will to Power, he says, "Let us admit to ourselves how every higher culture on earth so far has begun. Human beings whose nature was still natural were still in possession of unbroken strength and will and lust for power." So thus, the Übermensch was a higher state of being. And Darwin attempted to account for teleology, meaning, purpose, and value, on natural terms. Where Nietzsche took this idea and spiritualized it into a secular teleology. And so if you were to make a comparison here, what Darwin's idea of teleology, meaning purpose, what he did with that, he did it with nature. But what Nietzsche did that with, I don't know if that's grammatically correct way of saying that, but he made it in a philosophical, secularized, spiritual way. And so, in that same work, in The Will to Power, this is where we get the idea of staring into the abyss. Nietzsche states that man is a rope between the animal and the Übermensch, a rope over an abyss. And so this is where there's a very interesting paradox here. Nietzsche dreads the notion of nihilism, and he recognizes that it is imminent. It is an abyss that must be avoided. God could provide that meaning and value and purpose that is needed. But Nietzsche understands that the abyss is just that. So that abyss of nothingness is God, is Christianity, is Judaism. All right, and so the Übermensch provides that necessary teleology that he needs. And so notice what's the key to understanding Darwinian evolution? How does it work? Somebody say something? Yeah, how does it work?
Natural selection.
Natural selection and random mutation. And so, and also with that, who are the ones that survive? Yeah, the fittest. Survival of the fittest. Darwinian evolution. And Nietzsche uses that, and he says, those who suffer and are in pain are the ones who will become the Übermensch. And so there's that existential suffering and pain that creates that teleology for us. It's what makes us better, able to obtain the status of the Übermensch. All right, we'll come back to Nietzsche in a little bit about Camus. Camus believed that the world was not rational, and there were three ways of recognizing absurdity. The first one is that perceiving of man's indifference of values. So if you recognize that man is just indifferent to value, then you'll see how absurd we are. Second one is recognizing the finality of death. When you think about it, what time does this class get out? When you think about it, I mean, if there is no God, if Christianity isn't true, then life sucks. In the sense that you may have the idea, or you may think that you have meaning or purpose in this life, but if there is no God, you're just delusional. There are no moral values. You have no purpose, and you have no meaning. Because remember, under the Anselmian notion of God, those notions come from God, necessarily. All meaning, value, and purpose come from God. And so you may try to construct your own ideas of meaning, purpose, and teleology, like what Nietzsche tries to do with the Übermensch, or what Darwin does with random mutation and survival of the fittest. But this idea is actually, like I said, it's plaguing the sciences. Is anybody familiar with cosmology at all? Okay. If we look at the universe in a naturalistic way, the universe, of course, began 13.7 billion years ago, and just less than a second after that moment of the Big Bang, the universe underwent a tremendous moment of, well, redundant. It went through this moment of inflation, and so that's what allowed the universe to expand so rapidly. And so this is where we come to the understanding of the cosmological constant. Have you ever heard of Einstein's field equations? Einstein developed the idea. He used his field equations where the left side of the equation described the geometry of the universe, and the right side of the equation described the energy momentum of the universe. And he introduced this term called lambda. And lambda has become known as the cosmological constant. It's the Greek letter. And it's a force so small on that left-hand side, describing the geometry of the universe, that's what allowed for an eternal universe to exist, to have the steady state model, that the universe eternally existed and will always exist. But then, as you know, Hubble came around and he noticed, using Einstein's equations, a combination of Edouard Lemaître, a Belgian priest, and Hubble, they take his equations and they see the redshift in the sky of other galaxies moving further away at a constant rate. They know, well, the universe had to have a beginning, because if you extrapolate it, you come to some point of singularity. But in Einstein's equations, you just can't simply remove lambda from it. But if you put it on the right side of the equation, you redeem the equation. And so instead of this cosmological constant describing the geometry of the universe, it's describing the energy momentum. So what that means is that the universe is going to, the fate of the universe is going to end two different ways, or it has an option of ending two different ways. Either the force that, have you ever heard of dark energy? This is the idea. It's kind of like an anti-gravity in the sense of it. Instead of, gravity, if I throw this marker in the air, it comes back down. Pretty obvious. But if we translate dark energy to gravity, if I throw this up, it doesn't come back down. It just starts going faster and faster and faster away. So that's kind of how that works. And so if that dark energy is expanding the universe, either the force of gravity is going to contain that and it's going to crunch back in it on itself in the big crunch, or it's going to just expand forever. And I think, you know, if the universe just expands forever and meets a point of maximum entropy, a maximal state of chaos, we just have a dead universe. Everything comes to an equilibrium. There is no life. There is no heat. There's nothing. And so that's, no matter how hard you think that you are going to have some type of objective purpose in this life, it's all going to end the same. The universe is just going to get cold and it's going to die. It's just going to sit there eternally doing nothing. Has anybody ever read H.G. Wells? Have you read The Time Traveler? Yeah. In that book, Wells gives the idea, I don't have the section to like quote it to you, but he gives this idea of absurdity. You know, he goes into time travels to the future, and then when he comes to the future of Earth, there's nothing there but the moss on rocks and just like a windy wasteland. There's nothing left. And at that time, the time traveler recognizes, you know, he immediately goes into this despair of, this is the end of humanity. It's all going to come out to just nothing but a wasteland. There's nothing here for us. And so it's just desolate. And it's existentially absurd. So when he comes back, he's got this idea that we're not going towards anything but the state of having moss, a little bit of moss on rocks, with no plant life, nothing else. Everything's just going to die. And so that's how this idea of absurdity has just plagued the sciences. It's plagued literature, physics and mathematics and whatnot. So, all right, well, that was a long point on the finality of death. When you die, it's over. The third point is just to recognize life's pointlessness. Recognizing that life is pointless. That's the third way of recognizing absurdity. First one is man's indifference to moral values. Second one is the finality of life. When you die, you're done. That's it. And the pointlessness of life. Those are the three ways Camus says that you can recognize absurdity. And so Camus' deepest question is something that you've probably already thought about, whether in life or in light of the finality of the universe. And so maybe some of you are thinking, well, you guys are bright, you guys are honor students. What would you do in this situation? If you recognize that life is just absurd, there's no life after death, the universe is just going to end the way it's going to end. It's just going to reach a maximum state of entropy. When I say that means the Earth will not be the Earth. It's just going to be, the universe is just going to be empty. Everything's going to disintegrate almost and spread out. Because the Earth is order, maximum entropy is disorder. So what would you do if this was true? What's that?
Party?
Shoot yourself. Suicide. That was Camus' biggest question. Why not kill yourself? You know, it's honest. If the universe is just going to end this way, then I can do all the partying I want, and that can gratify me for the moment, but it doesn't become of anything greater. You can do partying and partying and partying and partying, but you end up with vanity of vanities. And so why not kill yourself? So What do you think Camus' answer to this was? Should you kill yourself or should you not kill yourself? Well, let me see a pull of hands. If all this were true, if there is objective absurdity, raise your hand if you would just kill yourself. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. All right, so feel free to abstain. Are there any who would not kill yourself? 1, 2, 3. Okay, a little bit more. Yeah, a little bit. That's the question. That's the question. Does it matter if you kill yourself or not? That's Camus' point. Is there a sense of indifference here? Well, Camus says that you shouldn't kill yourself because this is a sign of defeat. It's a concession to the absurd. It's basically saying absurdity won. And Camus' understanding of life is that you have to be a person of action. You have to participate in order to make any meaning or to create any teleology. You have to be a person of action. Everything you do has to be life-affirming and not life-denying. And of course, if you kill yourself, that's definitely life-denying. We'll get to that in a second. But you can kind of see the direction that we're going with. In the sense of D.L. Rue. Rue as in the French word for road, R-U-E. Rue had this idea called the noble lie. In the sense of when Rue recognized that, you know, this is true. Objective absurdity is true. What Rue said is, you know, you're going to have to make up a lie, and you're just going to have to tell yourself that there is meaning, even though there's not. So you base your whole life on a lie. You construct a lie being that you have purpose, that you ought to do certain things. I mean, you kind of see this with Camus. You kind of just, you do whatever you want. You construct a lie to live off of, because you can't live off of this. You should just kill yourself, but you create a lie to go off of. What are your thoughts on this? Is Camus being consistent, inconsistent? What do you think? And this is a moment where you just got to be honest with yourself. You know, I did my, let's see, this semester, I'm taking 3 classes this semester. C.S. Lewis, is anybody by chance in the C.S. Lewis class? I'm in the class on C.S. Lewis, philosophy of religion, which is actually taking place now, a couple rooms down. And the philosophy of science. And my second semester as a grad student, I took a course on existentialism. And I mean, I tell my professor quite often, is Professor Provenzola, I tell him that class ruined my life. In a paradoxical way, in the sense that it ruined my life and like my life sucks. And also in the way that it ruined it for the good, that I started being honest with myself more and more. Because, I mean, I'm sure some of you have already gone through it where you just have this point of existential reflection. And you're just like, I don't know what's going on. You recognize that subjective absurdity. And throughout that whole course, I mean, I was up and down. I was super depressed, or I was on cloud 9. And I did my term paper, I don't remember how many pages it was, like 24 pages or something, on the absurdity of life without God. Or the absurdity of life in the reconciliation by the divine telos, by God's providing that purpose. And I examined that through Dostoevsky and Kierkegaard and these other notions of philosophers reconciling that. And so I focused on Sartre, Camus, and Nietzsche. And actually became, I had a great appreciation for Camus and Sartre and Nietzsche. But it's, when you start reading things like Nietzsche, has anybody ever read Nietzsche before? Okay, which one did you read?
I just read passages that our teacher gave us, so I'm not really sure.
Okay.
Just pull pages out and say, read this.
Okay. Did you ever find yourself...
The one on the tightrope, like the guy who like, jumps off the tower on the tightrope, the one with the Übermensch, whatever.
Yeah, the Übermensch... It occurs in a few of the books, but it's emphasized in The Will to Power. So I haven't read the full Will to Power either, so I don't know if it's in that one. But there's a sense of depression when you read Nietzsche. Like, you read it, and he's just like, you know, all. If you've ever heard, you might have heard this quote, all the interesting people are not in heaven. I mean, think about it. In one sense, you're like, yeah. But in another sense, you know, when you start thinking Christianly, you're like, no. That's where, I mean, you start Christianizing everything. And so when you start Christianizing everything from the beginning, you lose the power and the depth of where they're going. So keep the Christian mindset to the side, and you come back to it after reading the existentialists. You take what they're saying, and you work with that. You get where they're coming from, what they're actually saying, and where they're going with it, and you get a greater appreciation for it. Okay, where was I going with that? You know, I had a point on that. I don't remember. Oh, about being...
Why should you do
this? Yeah. Yeah, so is Camus' response consistent with suicide's beckon? Yeah, suicide is calling on you. Do you concede to it or not? Yeah.
Well, first of all, his logical approach to how absurd life is without God, that would make sense to rule out the existence of God.
You know, what's interesting about Camus is that, or at least with humanists, humanists can be different religions in the sense there are secular humanists and there are Christian humanists or existentialists. But, you know, I don't know exactly Camus' reason for rejecting God, but Camus was killed in a car crash in France, I think in the 60s. But there's possibility that before he was killed in that accident, that he may have become a Christian. It's something you can ask Dr. Beck about it later, because he was the one telling me about this. And, you know, we were out at La Coretta having lunch one day, and I was, you know, it's just one of those honest questions that you just think about. I was like, do you think Aristotle's in heaven? I mean, he did a lot with that natural revelation. You know, you start thinking these things, or you're like, you want somebody to be in heaven, but you're not sure, or you know that they're not. And that's where he brought up Camus. It's like, you know what, he might be, because he was dialoguing with this other Christian. I think he was an American Christian. And it just seemed like Camus was coming around too. But, so, yeah, I don't know his exact reason for rejecting the existence of God. People like Nietzsche just said, well, the very concept of God is meaningless. and nihilistic. And so, yeah, the idea of nihilism in Nietzsche, that's why the term gets attached or predicated to Nietzsche. He was just terrified of nihilism. He did not want that to be true. And so he made his own teleology. But what do you think? Was he consistent or logically consistent with the idea that you should not kill yourself?
With the thing about lying to yourself to create meaning and purpose in life? I think you just kind of put a fake mask on his own drive to live, that drive that human nature has that defies absurdity. And if we have that drive, then there will be a purpose. And the existence of that nature implies that there is something more to life, more than natural selection.
Anybody else? Yeah.
I just don't understand where he gets that drive to, like, be. We have to overcome this absurdity. We can't kill ourselves, otherwise it wins. I don't understand where he's getting that from. If everything is just, but especially with the inevitability of death, you can't beat death. So why prolong?
It's interesting how he does this. Is that, remember, his reasons for not committing suicide is that you're conceding, you're not participating, you're not acting in life. And so you have to be a person of action to create that meaning and purpose. But notice how he puts that as a logical priority, or even a teleological priority, over the objective absurdity. It's backwards. And so I'd say that he is being inconsistent. Instead of making a person of action being absurd, or being what it is, he puts that before absurdity. I don't know if that follows. Yeah, it would be in an extrinsic way.
It seems like in order to participate in what he says is, which is that everything is coming to nothing, that you would want to kill yourself in order to participate in everything coming to nothing.
That's an interesting way of looking at it. Here's an example of what it means to participate or to be a person of action. Has anybody ever read Dostoevsky's The Underground Man? Or not The Underground Man. Notes from the Underground. Well, the main character, the Underground Man, is he's a person who's trying to participate. He's trying to act, but he can never seem to do it. You know, it takes place in the dreary Russia, and, you know, the sky is always a dark gray, and there's snow on the ground, and it's really depressing. And he does everything that he can to act with others, in the sense that he would go down to a bar and try to pick a fight, but he couldn't even do that right. He couldn't even get in a fight. And he didn't have any friends, he didn't have any associations. So when he tried to pick a fight with another person in the bar, he ended up just leaving and getting kicked out, thrown out of the bar. And so he wasn't satisfied with that because his goal didn't obtain. And so he was just trying to participate with others and trying to make an action for himself. He couldn't do it. I mean, we all have that desire to act and to do things in life. I mean, obviously, those of us in here have that desire to get that degree, to act and participate in society. Or just for the sake of doing it for yourself. And so that's where the idea of action comes along. But yeah, I don't think it's consistent here. Because the absurd seems to have a priority over that, in the sense of, because life is absurd, you have to construct your own teleology. And so he focuses on that construction of teleology, logically posterior, logically after his recognition of absurdity. And so it's backwards. Okay. All right, if God does not exist, kind of wrapping this part up, if God does not exist, then man lives in Bertrand Russell's scaffolding of despair. Has anybody heard of Russell, Bertrand Russell? Famous early 20th century atheist philosopher. He's one of the greatest atheist philosophers. When you think of Richard Dawkins, well, he's not a philosopher. He tries to be. Daniel Dennett and like Sam Harris, like these new atheists. Christopher Hitchens passed away recently. You know, they're nothing compared to Bertrand Russell or Nietzsche or any of the great atheist philosophers. But what's interesting here with Russell is that it says that man is merely the product of pointless cause and effects with no provision of the ends being achieved. All the labors of the age, devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system. Man's achievements are destined to be buried in the debris of the universe. Only within the scaffolding of these truths, teleological truths, only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. It's honest. So, with Nietzsche, one is forced to face his abyss, that moment of nothingness. Do you have a question? Yeah, you recognize it. And so, you know, scaffolding is, you know, if you go to a construction site, scaffolding is the cheap way of building a ladder. Or, I mean, it's not cheap, but, I mean, it's not a building itself. And so your truths are just scaffolding. It's something that's, I mean, it's not a building. It doesn't have a foundation. And so all these teleological truths, all these values, meaning and purpose is just scaffolding amongst absurdity. So Nietzsche is forced to look across the abyss and face the reality that no rope can scale the depth of nothingness, nothingness being that abyss, that nihilism. You're only left with despair, guilt, and angst. If one can determine that despair, guilt, and angst are not preferred, and his only option is to eliminate those emotions of thoughts. So even if you recognize that the result of reflection of absurdity, if you don't even want those to happen, if you, basically it's saying you should kill yourself. Even if not wanting them is greater, then killing yourself is the greater thing to do. But in the end, it doesn't matter. So, if there is no God, the only remedy for this absurdity is to participate in Nietzsche's abyss of nothingness, which is suicide. Now, here's an interesting paradox. Remember, Camus and Sartre and others disagree about suicide, that you should not kill yourself. Nietzsche didn't necessarily advocate it either. And remember, the Übermensch was that rope across the abyss of constructing something over nothing. And this is, we set aside our Christian context. Now let's look at what they have to say in the Christian context here. In the Christian context, God recognizes that death is the only way to overcome absurdity. And so, just like we were saying in the non-Christian context, it seems that suicide and death is the best way to remedy absurdity. Just kill yourself. And God recognizes that too. That death is the only way to do that. And so instead of us having to take on that death, God takes on that death. And so he introduces Christ, the Logos, the second person as the Godhead. He enters into absurdity, into this world of absurdity, and remedies it with death. And this is one of the most beautiful paradoxes in all of Scripture, of all of the Christian worldview. In the sense, both naturalistically and spiritually, death is necessary for life because of the fall. Now, remember, ecologically, there has to be death in order for life to thrive. You know, it was in Yellowstone, it was, I think it was either some type of deer or elk or some type of game. The population was not doing well. There was a lot of sick animals and whatnot. And so what they did is they introduced predators. They introduced wolves to that area. And because there was predation, because there was death, that allowed for that population that was being hunted to flourish in an interesting way. You introduce predation, you introduce death, and it flourishes. It gets rid of the diseased animals. Gets rid of, well, natural selection. It gets rid of the weak. Otherwise, the disease would infect the rest of them, and they would all die. But spiritually, there has to be death in order for us to live. It's because of the death of Christ that we are able to live, both now and beyond what would be the finality of death. And so the finality of death is reconciled. It's removed in this Christian context because of this divine suicide, if you want to look at it like that. And so all three of Camus' points are gone. The finality of death has disappeared. The pointlessness of life has been reconciled because God exists and because of that death. And that values, well, there are objective values. All right. With Sartre, we've kind of already talked about this with the existence precedes essence. So I'm not going to read that to you. I'm sure you've got the slides. It should be online. But the point with this, remember, you've gone through, did you already go through naturalism? Now, the question, the question here is, what do we make of person's reality, God, knowledge, and value? With the humanist or the existentialist, it's whatever you want it to be. You choose what you want God to be. You choose what knowledge is or how we attain knowledge. You choose to define a person. You choose your values. And so this is where the humanist will come up with the idea of Rue's noble lie. Whatever you want it to be. It's indifferent. Doesn't really matter, so you choose. Current humanism, it's still around. There's the Lynchburg, the Lash. Ironic, I guess. Or, I don't know, Lynchburg area secular humanists. If you ever go down, it's either Church Street or Main Street, the highway pickup, the adopt a highway thing. Pretty sure it's Church Street downtown. they have that adopt the highway. They came in, and we, our philosophy of religion class debated them a few years ago, like 3 years ago, and they came in, and so it was like 12 of us in the class versus like three of them. It's very interesting. Their whole thing was like evolution is true, the Bible is false, there is no God. You know, that doesn't follow at all. I mean, even if evolution is true, it doesn't follow that the Bible's not true. And it doesn't, because it may be the case that the Bible does allow for evolution. Anyways, Prometheus Press, that's a famous publisher. Victor Stenger's book, I believe, was published through them. You know, what's interesting with humanism is that most of them are the secular humanists. Most existentialists and humanists are secular in the sense of they don't believe there is God. But the most humanistic worldview is Christianity in the sense of it makes sense of the values of humans. It allows for and projects on to persons a sense of value. You don't live by this noble lie, and so this has the greatest value for the good of human beings. And so with that, you don't take in the absurdities. You recognize the absurdities, and you recognize that paradox of life and death and the cross. And so that's how Christianity provides the greatest good for human beings, by providing that value. Okay. Definitely not going to read this to you. But this is their statement of principles, their statement of faith, or whatever you want to call it. And if you've got, I mean, I know that y'all are busy, but if you've got time, read through it and recognize how interesting it is. And so, I guess the main point to understand with this is to recognize that if there is no God, like over there, if there is no God, then there is objective absurdity. Throughout your whole life, if you haven't had it yet, you're going to have it sometime soon, most likely. You're going to recognize Camus' 3 points at some point or another. You're going to go through a time of despair and depression. And that's okay. It's part of the Christian walk to recognize that. And also, I mean, when you think about the Übermensch and these constructions, the noble lies, the scaffolding of despair, notice the paradox of how Christianity and God constructs that bridge across that nothingness, that abyss of nihilism, of pointlessness. And that Christianity, if you want to focus on humanity, is the best worldview for that. And so to secularize it doesn't make sense, and it is a concession into the absurd if you do that. Okay, any questions about any of this? Did that make sense? Yeah.
What is the difference
between
existentialism and nihilism? Yeah.
You can be an existentialist without being a nihilist. Nihilism is the idea that everything is pointless. Everything is nothing. There are no values. There are no objective purpose. But one can still be an existentialist in the sense of, you know, it can recognize that everything is objectively absurd or nihilistic, but the existentialist could construct that. The nihilist will just live by this. The nihilist isn't going to construct his own scaffolding. He's not going to throw a rope across the abyss and try to attain the Übermensch. So the nihilist is going to live by this. And of course, the Christian existentialists will look at it in the way that we just talked about of that paradox of life and death. Life and death. Any other questions? Did that make sense? Did I not make sense? Were you tracking? All right. Well, I think my email might be on the faculty contact in Blackboard. If you have any questions, let me know, or just let Dr. Beck know, and I'll do what I can for you. So I'm sure I'll be seeing you later. Dr. Beck gives me free range in the fine-tuning argument, so I know I'll be back there, back again for that. Well.